con IPR On Air, un ciclo di interviste condotte dai professori e personalità di Ateneo. Un modo per scoprire il futuro anche più immediato, tra nuove strade e nuovi modelli sociali, culturali, politici, economici e altro ancora. I professori Furio Brighenti e Daniele Del Rio intervistano Philip Calder e Annemieke van Ginkel.
Good morning, I'm Professor Furio Brighenti of the University of Parma. I'm Professor of Human Nutrition and I'm glad to welcome you for this new episode of the series Parma on Air. You know, this is a channel we treat the future challenges of our societies. Of course, in this period, one of the major challenges is COVID-19 pandemic. And among the different consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's very important to look at the effect that it had, and it has, and it will have on our food habits, including the consequences of our changing food habits, such as the nutritional status of individuals and populations. So that's why I'm very glad to be here and to discuss in the next half an hour with the two very important guests. First is Dr. Annemieke van Ginkel. She is an honorary president of the European Federation of Associations of Dietitians, which is a federation of professional health professionals, and is also member of the board of trustees of the European Nutrition Health Alliance and the European Foundation for Dietetics and Nutrition. Welcome, Annemieke. And our second guest is Professor Philip Calder. He's head of the School of Human Development and Health and a professor of nutritional immunology at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Southampton, United Kingdom. He's also president of FENS, which is the Federation of European Nutrition Societies. It's a federation that collects 26 different academic, scientific, and professional nutrition societies across Europe in different countries. As a co-chair, I'm also glad to introduce Professor Daniele Del Rio. He's professor of human nutrition at the University of Parma, and is also here as a head and a president of the School for Advanced Studies on Food and Nutrition, which is a postgraduate school of the University of Parma, which offers qualified training, courses, and research support for developing professional roles and scientific roles in the field of food and nutrition. So I don't want to take more time from the interesting chat that we'll have now. So I leave the word to Daniele for the first question.
Thank you, Furio. So I'm going to go straight to the first question, and I'm going to be addressing Philip. Bye, Philip. Thank you for being here. It was very nice for you to say immediately yes, knowing your terrible agenda and calendar. And I know it's not so common to have you, you know, giving this type of interview, and we're really proud. So the first question is about the COVID situation and poor nutritional status. We've heard a lot of news about the fact that if you were not eating okay, if you were in condition of poor nutrition, maybe deficient of vitamin D or other micro or macronutrients, you were in a condition of high risk of getting COVID and also maybe high risk of a bad outcome after the infection. We've heard about a lot of different molecules, even non-nutrients like polyphenols and quercetin very recently. So what is true and what is actually fake in all this talking about nutrients, micronutrients, non-nutrients, dietetic compounds, and COVID risk and outcome?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for inviting me to take part in the discussion. I think it's great to focus on this topic. And as a starting question, I think this is a really important one. So the fact of the matter is we know a reasonable amount about the role of nutrition in supporting the immune system. But at this stage, we don't know a lot about nutrition and coronavirus and COVID-19 in particular. So we have to take the information we already have about how nutrition supports immune function and translate that to the COVID setting and then do research to see if that holds true. So We know that a whole range of micronutrients are really important in supporting the immune system. So you mentioned vitamin D, but also vitamins A, C, and E are really important. Many trace elements, zinc, selenium, iron, copper, for example. Other essential nutrients like some of the amino acids, the fatty acids. These are all known to have important roles in how the immune system is working, and they're well known to support optimal immune function. And we know that from studying people in deficiency states and also from human studies where increased intakes of those specific nutrients have been used. So we know a fair amount about that. And therefore, the suggestion would be that having a good status of those nutrients, so good intake and good status, would help people if they happen to be infected with coronavirus. So, for example, it might enable you to combat the infection and therefore prevent the disease from becoming more serious. Now, recently, there have been data that have come out looking at the status of some of these nutrients, for example, vitamin D, selenium, and zinc have all been looked at. And the observational data is that people with more severe COVID-19 do have a lower status of those nutrients than healthy people out in the community. So I think there is a role for the, let's call them the traditional micronutrients and essential nutrients. You ask also about phytochemicals and sort of non-nutritional food components. Much less is known about those. That's not to say that they may not be important, but we just don't know enough yet. So I would be a little bit hesitant myself to recommend some of these things to people because you're really trying to give people a sense of security and you don't want that to be misplaced. I would rather at this stage that we focused on the more traditional nutrients and healthy eating patterns to make sure people get enough of those. And there's also maybe later on we'll go into the question of obesity as well, which is sort of the other side of the coin, but we maybe we'll come back to that.
Okay, thank you. I think that's perfect. Annemieke, do you want to add anything to Philip's?
No, I can only agree with Professor Calder, of course. What we see is in different stadia of COVID patients being in hospital, being at home, or in a recovery state, we as dietitians has to talk to the patients to see what they can eat at a day. And of course, at the ICU, you see a lot of parenteral and enteral nutrition. And of course, we try to make that as a full nutritional, a good nutritional that all the nutrients are covered in this food. When people are recovered, in a rehabilitation status and at home, we see that people can try to begin to eat good food and normal food, but always with some support of oral nutritional supplementation. And dietitians will coach people to a normal food pattern again. And sometimes that's within 4 weeks, but sometimes it costs 3 months because people are nausea, they are tired, they are sick, and not in the status of cooking or doing their groceries. So there are lots of problems in this phase after having COVID and being in the hospital.
That's interesting. So Annemieke, it seems that a good nutritional status is, in any case, even in the case of infection, something which protects. We have seen a lot of information reports about the higher risk that obese people has to die once they get the infection. So the 80% almost of the people who died were obese. Is this condition, in your opinion, a true risk, the first true risk, obesity, or maybe just a covariate, something that is the reflection of an underlying situation of deprivation, which means also maybe having a worse nutritional status? So the two things could be linked together or not. And then again, in your opinion, can be the scale of something which is so impelling, such as an infection which can make you sick immediately, be a propulsion toward a better following nutritional guidelines than just looking at the consequences long term, such as chronic diseases?
Yes, we see that if I understand you well, that obesity is related to a higher risk to suffering from COVID. Of course, obesitas is a lower nutritional status, but people, 50 to 60% of people in countries have overweight and obesity, and I think it's very important to that people realize now that when they are obese, they have higher risk on diabetes and a cardiovascular risk, but also on having an higher risk on inflammation and an higher risk on influenza, but also on COVID. So when people are realizing that, we hope and we see also, and also we stress in the dietetic practice that people are going to are willing to do something about that and change their lifestyle in a more healthier lifestyle. That means that healthy food, of course, but also more exercise and changing behavior. What you see in the lower income, that it is more difficult to work on that, because when you don't have that much money, you can't afford healthier food, because what we see is that it is more expensive, and unhealthy food is more expensive, is cheaper, of course, and that's also I'm so sorry, I can't find a word for it, but when you are in low income, then it is more difficult to adjust a healthier lifestyle. We see that too, but it is feasible with good coaching and with in a multidisciplinary setting. We see it in Holland that in the cities where programs are running for obese children in low income areas, we see by having more activity and better food, they lose weight and getting healthier. So, yeah, was that a question?
It was this one. I know.
Maybe I could jump in as well. So I think this perspective is very good, but I think the question actually is also very good, because it's unclear whether the increased risk of obese people to severe COVID-19 is simply the obesity, or whether it's other things that might happen to be associated with obesity. And you suggest that an element of that actually might be poor micronutrient status. And I think, you will have individuals where obesity is excess calories beyond need, where the nature of the food that has given rise to the obesity as part of a lifestyle actually isn't delivering the essential nutrients that a person needs. So I think you can have this coexistence of obesity and some form of malnutrition. Nevertheless, we do know that obesity has a direct impact on obesity impacts the immune system, and obese people have weaker immune responses. They don't respond so well to the influenza vaccination, for example. And even if they're vaccinated, obese people are more at risk of influenza than normal weight people. So there is something about obesity. Again, we're not sure whether it's obesity per se or something else that weakens the immune system, that might be part of this predisposition to severe COVID-19. Of course, obese people often also have respiratory issues because of their overweight. So that might be part of it as well. We heard mention of the low-grade inflammation, which is elevated in obese people, that could predispose to hyperinflammation when people get into a particular clinical situation. So I think it's probably a complex mixture, but what it has done, I think in many countries, is it has focused people's minds on the health consequences of being overweight and obese. And often people are not so concerned that they might develop heart disease in 20 or 30 years or diabetes in 10 years. But when it seems that actually there's an infection in the environment that can cause fatality, this could really focus people's minds on the need to lose weight. So I think this could be actually a positive outcome from the current pandemic, actually.
I like this positivity, actually. Can I just go out of script for a minute and, yep. and add something? I was actually thinking the opposite. So what we saw in Italy, I think a couple of years ago, maybe 2015, 2016, was that the childhood obesity was on a rampage scale. Someone from the WHO said that the Mediterranean diet was gone, because this was true for Spain, it was true for Italy, it was true for all the Mediterranean countries, okay? And actually we were scared, and the numbers were there. So it's true, actually childhood obesity in Italy now is higher than many non-Mediterranean countries. So one of the reasons, if you check 10 years ago, 10 years from that, you know, data set, that means at the beginning of maybe 2006, we were actually suffering a deep economic crisis back then. So one of the reasons might have been that when these 10 years, 11 years old children in 2016 were just born, the families were suffering an economic crisis. They didn't have the, you know, the buying power that they should have had. And this reduced the quality of their diet. So can this be also true for the COVID situation? Because we are already suffering, and we will suffer an economic crisis post-COVID for quite some years, I think. I think the big thing still has to come out. So cannot, I mean, what I don't want to happen is the opposite of what you're saying, that beside the push to, you know, be better, behave better, but you then, you don't have the capacity, the economic capacity to buy healthy foods, to have access to a healthy diet, and the affordability is also going to be impacted, because everybody is impacted. So this might actually become a vicious cycle instead of a virtuous cycle, where this crisis is going to make us even less prepared to the next one. What do you think about this?
I think I hadn't really thought about it quite like that, but I think your point is a really good one, that already, obviously, none of the countries are completely through the pandemic yet, and we don't know when that's going to end, but already the economic impact of the pandemic is quite substantial, and I think that will get worse over the next little while as government support maybe eases off on some people. So I think, you know, many people will lose their jobs, for example. Many types of, I'm going to call them industries, but, you know, commercial endeavors will not be viable anymore. So I think we will go through a difficult financial time, and that for a substantial part of the population, it may be difficult for them to maintain the sort of lifestyle, including the diet, that they would like to have. So there could be a long-term consequence in terms of poor diet. And, you know, there is this also this theory about early life origins of later disease, that actually a poor period for a couple of years could actually have an impact for decades to come. So I think that's going to be really important for the governmental authorities to be really thinking about supporting the population.
So public health nutrition in the next, you know, 2 years needs to be, you know, a top priority for governments. That's what I think.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Too. I think that the after the scare, even your Prime Minister Johnson, Mr. Johnson, no, he focused on the obesity in UK. No, he put the campaign on fighting obesity because of the scare of the COVID he got. maybe there is some raised awareness of regulators on the importance of nutrition, even in time of crisis, which can be either a pandemic, but also an economic crisis.
But I think besides economic crisis, I think it's also important to be aware of the fact that people sometimes don't know how to live healthy. And especially for children, what you see is that also in schools, the activity and the exercise is becoming less. And also in the southern countries, we saw that the Mediterranean diet is a very positive diet, but children there are also confronted with McDonald's and all that kind of fast food change. And I think that's also something about it's maybe in an economic crisis, but also having access to that kind of welfare food. And that's maybe also the paradigm between those two. I think that's maybe the problem too. And if you look at the dietitian's point of view, I think a dietitian or as a coach could help families, children, but in every part of the lifespan, you sometimes have problems to cook a good food. We should try to have to be able to have that every European citizen could be had access to good nutritional and dietetic advice from time to time. And I think that's what we're talking about with the WHO too, accessibility of primary care and dietary and nutritional advice should be there too and in place to prevent from more obesity problems in the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in again because you touch on something that's also very interesting about the pandemic, which is the impact on people's physical activity. So I think for many people, this period has had an adverse impact on physical activity.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have, like me, have spent the last 6 months working at home. So we actually have hardly had to leave the house, which is very unusual. Although many people actually probably have increased their physical activity because they've had more opportunity, because they've had more time, maybe because they haven't been able to work. So I think there is a sort of a paradox there that some people could have been impacted adversely, but others not. And I know certainly in the UK, there's been a huge appetite for TV-based fitness training during the lockdown period, because all of the gyms have been shut, for example. So again, there could be sort of mixed things coming out of the pandemic, but you can imagine a situation where people's diets are impacted adversely and their physical activity is impacted adversely. And then going forward, as we said, their financial outlook is impacted adversely. This is going to be a really bad set of things that could be happening for some people.
Absolutely.
I'm just going to add that I bought a treadmill during the lockdown. So I did some exercise, but I also unplugged a lot of bottles of wine because
that's right.
Were actually delivering at home. It was super easy. So
yeah, and that's true. The people drank more alcohol during this pandemic.
True.
We'll cut that bit out.
Look, again, another interesting question, which regards, again, the behavior of people, including how will they follow advice and suggestions from their healthcare. We have been exposed as never before to science in this period. No, we have read a lot, we have seen a lot about scientific concepts such as epidemiology, such as whatever. Uncertainty, virus, discovery of vaccines, and so on. But we also saw a lot of charlatanism, especially on the social media about that. So, and even some politicians now brought some, you know, some message which could be not completely science-based.
Like injecting you with disinfectant or okay. stuff like that.
So, in your opinion, so since science understanding is so important, even for the everyday choice that we have to do, such as eating a good diet, a proper diet, this overexposition to science, you know, and to scientific concept will be a help, or maybe will add confusion to the understanding of the population?
It can be very confusing because there are so many people talking about science, and also the different perspectives are there, and sometimes for a consumer it's not good to recognize whether whether they should follow the one or the other. I think it is important that we, in a, for instance, in the nutritional world, with nutritionists, dietitians, but also with doctors, should try to speak one voice. And it is something from these times that everyone is exposed to so many media channels. It's social media, it's the broadcasting, so much. And I think regarding diets or nutritional advice, you should, we as scientists and we as practitioners should try to give one message to the audience instead of talking and discussing with each other and sometimes giving the opposite advices. So I think we should collaborate on that.
Yeah, I think this has been, again, it's a double-edged sword. So I think the expectations of the general public of science are quite high. So, for example, when people started talking about, we will try to develop a vaccine, you know, the public thinks, oh, this is wonderful. The scientists are going to solve the problem for us. But of course, first of all, a vaccine may be very difficult to develop. It's even if it happens, it's going to take quite a long period of time. And a vaccine, of course, may not protect everybody. So there's sort of, you've got a positive message about science developing a vaccine, but you've got all of these other subtleties behind it, which are never really communicated. And I think, you know, the level of science literacy in the population, unfortunately, is not as great as we would like it to be. And what's happened, I think, as often happens, is, you know, you hear about a drug or a vaccine or all sorts of things, fake things, nonsense, all sorts of things. Then you hear the government says, you know, we're basing our approach to our advice on the pandemic on the science, which is a message which has been used here in the UK from the start. But of course, because the pandemic characteristics are changing, the advice has to change, and that looks like the scientists don't really know what they're doing. So what comes out of this is the usual, which is the public actually thinks science isn't the answer and the scientists don't really know what they're doing. So I think this again is a demand for education of the public and raising their science literacy. Unfortunately, you know, there are mixed messages. People are very receptive to unusual, they could be unusual nutritional approaches, but they might be other things as well, which is a great shame. But we have to, again, this has been brought out by the pandemic, that there is a need to better educate the public for science-related challenges. And, you know, that includes climate change. Sustainability. These are all big science questions that impact all of society, so people have to really understand a little bit more.
Big challenges that we have ahead are, for example, the one on sustainability of food production and climate change and so on. This disease is a zoonotic disease because it has been passed from animals to humans. So could this put into perspective also a sort of a reduction of the need that we have, the fact that we have to rely so much on animal intensive animal products? So, I mean, safety, food safety and sustainability can be have a major impulse now to work together to reach some goal.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So I think what the pandemic has exposed is precarious position in which even the most wealthy nations find themselves when there is a significant external challenge. And I think the issue of how humans interact with the environment, which includes how we get our food, has been exposed by the pandemic. Obviously, I mean, the most obvious thing is, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, international transportation was basically closed down for a period of time. And we in Europe are very reliant on food coming from outside of Europe. And there was a lot of concern, actually, that we wouldn't have the food that people are used to getting, whether that be healthy food or less healthy food. But it exposed, actually, the vulnerability of the European food system to these external stresses. And behind this is this relationship between humans and their environment, and, you know, climate change, sustainability, the nature of the food system. So I think that's been really, I mean, there's no answer right now to this, but we really got to focus on this going forward, because this has been exposing the deficiencies in our system, and we need to do something about it. Because even if, you know, coronavirus, or when coronavirus goes away, you know, something else will happen, and it could be, you know, an acceleration of climate change. It could be something else, but, you know, something else might happen, and we need to be prepared for that, because, you know, our way of life is threatened by those things. But of course, our way of life is also a contributor to those things. So we have to really, this is a philosophical thing that we really have to start thinking about now.
Okay, right. What about, I'm actually asking the last question and to try to close. So we're going to close with one question addressed to both of you. Maybe a very kind of short and definitive answer. We're gonna face a situation where, as we discussed during this chat, public policies and public health nutrition are going to be very relevant. You're the heads of the two main European, let's say, federation institutions, like super institutions, in terms of dietetics and nutrition, okay? The dietitians and the nutritionists on the other side. Research and nutrition and dietetics, even in practice, on the other side, but also research in dietetics from the side of IFAD. So do you think that FENS and IFAD could be relevant somehow, maybe, I don't know, pushing governments, organizing international studies and surveys to try to, or maybe even aligning recommendations to try to fight, well, the post-COVID situation, and also even maybe to try to prevent a future, you know, we've been hearing about it's going to happen again many times. So even to prevent this to be so damaging like this specific one was. So do you think you two as heads, of course, with all the other people, so not personally, but the institution can actually do something? And how would you do that? And now good luck to reply in a very short amount of time.
Now, maybe I can start with answering this very short. I think, of course, it is a very big challenge, but I think it's feasible. And what AFAD is doing is try to collaborate with other EU societies And for instance, with Aspen, we have a relationship with the EASO. With the WHO, we are a non-state actor member now, and we are talking with the EU, and we are trying to get, for instance, the accessibility, and I said it already, to nutritional and dietary advice, because I think it's important that people learn what is healthy and what isn't healthy, and I think this should only be done in collaboration with other societies. And I think, and I want to introduce Fens also to work with AFAD, and we try to get in contact, because I think if you look at the nutritional advice and nutrition science, that's the basis of the dietary advice and making the science to practice to the consumers, and there's where our role is, I think.
Yeah, so I'm going to agree totally, because I think we need a joined up approach across the different disciplines. And Fins is representing people who are mainly scientists, so they're generating the evidence base for which public health, which would inform public health policy, which would inform practice through the dietetic community and so on. So I think we do have a role in this, but it is a multi-organization role. And actually, just to counter your point, Fens have sent your organization a request to join in an activity as well. So we have to join this up. But so I think, but that's part of actually the answer to the question, that people are now thinking we can't solve this alone, but we can be part of the solution if we work together.
That's perfect.
Thanks a lot.
And maybe can I say something? Absolutely. Last? I think it's very important to look at how patients and consumers are how is their nutritional status. And at this moment, over 30 million people in Europe are malnourished. So screening and treatment and diagnosing is very important. And I think that's also, next to obesity, a very big challenge in Europe.
Okay. Fantastic. I think that thanks a lot for all the food for thought that you gave us today. I want to thank you on behalf also of our community of academics of the University of Parma and students of the University of Parma. And I'm sure that we'll shape some new way also to evolve our teaching, our research, taking into account these perspectives, which are very wide, very difficult to cope with, very difficult to work with, but are the future of our generation. So thanks really a lot for your presence here.
Thank you for the invitation and getting us here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and well, I hope the next time is going to be something like live instead of you know, behind the screen. We're kind of getting
my agenda already.
Some wine.
Yeah, with some red wine on a treadmill.
On a treadmill. Yeah.
On a treadmill. Okay. Thank you for your time, guys. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Nice to see you all.